Hey, my name's Emma.
Hey, my name's Maddie.
And you're listening to The Pilots Pandemic.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Pilots Pandemic Podcast. You're here with your host, Emma, and our lovely co-host, Maddie.
Hello, everyone.
This week, we are joined with a very, very, very special guest. High emphasis on very. We are sitting here today with Mr. Brent Blue. Brent is a senior AOPA AME advisor, as well as a HIMSS AME and a pilot. Thank you so much, Brent, for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Great to talk with you all.
So as our listeners are probably very familiar with, we always ask all of our guests at the top of the show, why did you start your path in aviation? And was there somebody or something that sparked that passion?
Well, I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, right next to Bowman Field, which was a very active training airport at that time. It dated back to World War II era and was a commercial airport. But after the commercial airport moved, it became a very active GA airport. They were training so many pilots that they would land one plane on the runway and a plane on the grass on either side. So literally three landings simultaneously. And it was a pretty exciting place. And it was always great. Because at least twice a year, the Goodyear blimp would come in and stay there overnight. That was pretty exciting.
I know for a young boy, that's got to be like just such a treat. I grew up probably a mile down the street from our teeny tiny little regional airport. And it was just so fun watching the planes fly in and out each day. Even though my dad was a pilot, that definitely like inspired me to want to stay in aviation.
Well, no one in my family was a pilot, and they weren't too excited about me becoming one either. So,
do you mind me asking why?
I think my family is a pretty conservative, not adventurous type of family, so I'm sort of out there on the limits for them.
I got you.
So our next question, Brent, was, why did you want to become an aviation medical examiner? And can you explain some of the duties that is part of your job to our audience?
Sure. An aviation medical examiner is the person who essentially examines pilots for first, second, and third class medicals. And I became one after I became a physician because it allowed me to work with pilots and just be involved in the aviation community. And I liked helping pilots get their medicals, especially when they had medical issues that caused difficulties. The main difference between a senior AME and a regular AME is a senior AME can do first class medicals, and you become a senior AME after you've been a regular AME for a year or so, and then apply for that senior designation. And the regional flight surgeon grants that based on your performance as a regular AME.
Can you also explain the difference between the HIMSS AME and an AME as well, since that's part of your credentials?
First thing is that the difference between a first and second class medical and a third class medical is mostly vision.
Got gut issues? Because Emma and I sure do. I have an issue with high sugar foods and anything with added preservatives, and Emma has a whole ass gluten intolerance. So we struggle with finding tasty treats, but thank the heavens for Avinola, because it has been a lifesaver when we want a sweet treat fix without all the gut bums that high gluten foods like cookies and cakes give us.
Avinola has a chocolate granola that is made with lupini beans, so it's gluten-free and only has 1 gram of sugar, leaving our sweet tooth satisfied and our tummies feeling perfectly fine.
You guys, you can head over to avi-foods.com or the Instagram account at avi_foods_co for your granola fix turned tasty treat fix. You'll also find all kinds of recipes to try out, so you'll never get bored with Avinola. Use code PILOTSPANDEMIC for 15% off your order of Avinola.
Intervention motivational study. And that was a study the FAA commissioned many years ago in order to license or get pilots back into the cockpit after drug and alcohol issues. Before, if a pilot had a drug or alcohol issue, they were going to never be able to fly again. And that was a very onerous problem for the pilot and a very expensive issue for airlines, because it meant they lost a trained pilot. It cost a lot for an airline to train a pilot. So anytime they lose a pilot for whatever reason, it's an expensive venture. That HIMSS program was very successful, and then they expanded that to second and third class pilots, and they continued to call it HIMSS, which I don't know why they didn't change the name, but that's what they just call it. To become a HIMSS AME, you have to take a week-long course that is held usually once a year in various locations around the country. And the HIMSS part of things is mainly for drug and alcohol issues. However, they threw the antidepressant certification, the special issuance antidepressant pilots into that HIMSS program, even though it really doesn't belong there.
Yeah. So that was going to be my next question for you. As a HIMSS AME, you deal with a little bit more of a difficult job because you're a necessity to an aviator's medical if they have to navigate the special issuance pathway. So my question is to you, and I probably know the answer, but we have people ask us this a lot. Why do aviators have to go to you, a HIMSS AME, to navigate down the SI pathway, even though this is a program set up for addicts?
Well, the HIMSS program was set for drug and alcohol issues. So I think using the word addict is a little pejorative, but the SSRIs were just thrown in there, I think, because there wasn't any other place to put it by the FAA medical office, and that's where it ended up. We certainly cover the SSRI designations and special issuance in the HIMSS courses and the recurrent education courses that we all have to take to maintain the HIMSS designation. Being a HIMSS AME just means we're trained a little bit more on how to evaluate drug and alcohol issues. And since the FAA requires some of the same sort of evaluations for the pilots who've had depression or anxiety, I think that's kind of the reason why they have to see us. I don't think it's necessarily a great system, but that's the way it is right now.
Yeah, I definitely want to go back on to my point using the word addict. Yes, that's probably not a great term to use. We do speak to people who unfortunately have to go down the HIMSS pathway, even though they have no abuse issues. But we definitely speak to people who struggle with that, and we accept those realities on this platform.
Yeah, alcohol abuse disorder and drug abuse issues obviously are big issues, and obviously even magnified for pilots. I don't think that the FAA's current way to evaluate pilots is in accordance with modern medicine at this point. But it's what we have and what we're dealing with at this point. especially with the SSRI pilots, the pilots on antidepressants, some of the stuff is just, well, from my viewpoint, inappropriate.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We agree for sure with that. I was just going to ask you some questions that we, Em and I, typically get a lot from pilots in our DMs and then through email as well, or just in conversation. But we obviously have answered these questions ourselves, but it's always best to have an expert answer them. So I was just going to ask you three successive questions that we've gotten from pilots before and many times. So the first one is, when you have to take a P test for your medical, what is actually being tested?
For the medical, we're testing for blood and sugar, or in other words, we're testing for mainly for diabetes. That's the glucose in urine, and we're testing for blood, which can show certain kinds of kidney disease.
Okay, that's a solid answer. We love to hear it. I'm sure that relieves a little some of our pilots that are wondering.
They're all wondering whether we're testing for drugs.
That's the big one. I think that's the question that they really have, but they don't ask it in that way. So the next one that we get asked quite a bit is, if you've been denied a third class medical, are you able to fly under basic med?
No. In order to fly under basic med, your last medical, whatever that last medical is, and the medical has to have been in effect earlier. Let me say it this way: your medical has to have been in effect by July 2006 or later, because there was a 10-year look back when the basic med was started in 2016. Your last medical cannot have been revoked, denied, or not canceled, but anyways, it had to have been a valid medical, your last one. So you have to have had a medical either initially, or your renewal has to have been valid in order for you to do basic med.
Okay, that's it. That's good, because a lot of times I think we're kind of muddy that water there. So I'm glad that you had said that, because that question is constantly asked, and we have all different answers from all types of people. So that's good to know.
No, that's in the regulations. It's on the AOPA site. I mean, they're all very clear. The key thing, and I recommend basic med to a lot of pilots, because many times the FAA requires recurrent annual testing that is really not clinically indicated, and pilots can switch to basic med and not have to do those tests that are not clinically indicated.
Okay. And then the last one that we have for you is, if you want to take care of your mental health, is it better as a pilot, is it better to let your medical lapse and reapply for a medical, or is it better to go down the special issuance pathway?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question, in the sense that if a pilot has a mental health issue and they have a current medical, they are required to report that to the FAA. If they do not have a current medical and are not currently flying, then there is no requirement to report that to the FAA. If a pilot wants to go to basic med and they've had a mental health issue, depending on the type of mental health issue, they probably will qualify for basic med, but they cannot have a psychosis or serious depression I can't remember the other criteria, but you can't be schizophrenic, you can't have a serious psychosis, and those are issues that you have to get a medical for. If you're going to basic med, you have to go get a third class before you can switch over to basic med.
Okay. I think I was asking that because I've noticed that sometimes, at least the aviators that I've talked to, if they self-ground themselves and allow their medical to lapse and then go and get help for, let's say, depression, it seems that it's easier than to go down the special issuance pathway to try to maintain your medical.
Well, going down the special issuance pathway is always difficult. I mean, not only because of what has to be submitted to the FAA, but because the FAA is so backed up at this point, it can take an incredible amount of time to get your medical under special issuance. So that's a significant problem. I have one pilot who he's a HIMSS pilot, and is a first class HIMSS pilot, and he's been waiting so long for his medical certification that he's going to have to get another medical in order to fly, because the AME exam is going to have expired by the time the medical's his special issuance is granted. So it's almost a full year that he's been waiting.
Wow. For us, like most of the pilots that we've talked to in that pathway typically take about 24 months. So I agree with you that it's way too long of a process, and I'm hoping that it becomes more efficient.
I think I lost your audio there for a second.
Oh, I was just saying that I agree with you there. Like a lot of the pilots that we've spoke to have taken about 24 months in the SI process for an SSRI. So I agree with you in that it's just not an efficient process right now.
Yeah, it's a very tedious system at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So we covered your forum talk at Oshkosh last year on one of our episodes. This was last year again, but we did really resonate with a lot of the things that you had said last year at Osh, one of those being your opinions on cognitive screening. You said that you'd like to see a change in how pilots are evaluated with anxiety/depression, and that the cog screen is totally inappropriate. So I agree with you in this thinking. We've talked about this a lot on the podcast. We're not huge fans of the cog screen, but we want to know your opinion and why you think that. So definitely elaborate for us.
Well, when a pilot is evaluated for psychological issues or psychiatric issues, one of the requirements is to see a neuropsychologist and or a neuropsychiatrist, depending on the specific diagnosis. Those two folks have to be FAA approved or board certified. It depends. Sometimes they can just be a board certified psychiatrist, but many times they have to be an FAA approved board certified psychiatrist or an FAA approved neuropsychologist. For initial screenings now, they require a cog screen for psychological issues of pilots on SSRIs and specifically, and they require cog screens for pilots with drug and alcohol issues. The cog screen was a test that was invented by a guy named Gary Kay, who owns the copyright and patent, and who receives around $100 or so for everyone that's done, whether he performs it or anybody else. And it's an interactive computer system where you use a touchscreen, and it's supposed to check your memory and your dexterity and a few other things like that. If you read my last article in the ALPA magazine, the cog screen has never been shown to prevent an accident. It is a test that is that there have been several studies done on in various journals. The last one was in the year 2000. Of the studies that were done, there were about 20 of them. About 80% of those studies had Dr. K either as a lead author or one of the authors, which is a significant conflict of interest. And I don't know why the FAA uses cog screen the way they do, but it's I guess it's mainly just an objective test that for the FAA is basically a yes-no test, which means that someone could go to a neuropsychologist and a psychiatrist and pass with flying colors, but if they don't do well on the COG screen, they're not going to get their medical back. And I find that truly offensive. I mean, it just makes no sense to me whatsoever. And I trained with Dr. K. I learned how to do the COG screen and actually bought the equipment to perform it. And after I did it a few times, I realized that this was just a ridiculous thing to make pilots do. And I'm not in favor of it in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, we've talked to a couple of people who have done it before, and I know this is not like exactly what it is, but it does just sound like a very long computer game. I always joke, you got to go play Pac-Man for them for a little while to prove if you're fit to fly. And also, it, like Maddie said before, you know, that's a very small window of time compared to how you behave throughout your entire life. So
yeah. The thing that drives me crazy about it, I mean, I had one pilot, a airline pilot who was required to take the COG screen once a year. He took it 26 times, 26 years. There's no test that is valid in that setting. And the other thing is that he also had to take a sim check because he's an airline pilot. He had to do a sim check every 6 months. If you can pass a sim check, there's no reason why you should say a COG screen has any significance whatsoever. I mean, what is the most, or the best way to evaluate a pilot's performance? If they can get in the simulator and pass a sim check, what the hell are we doing with a COG screen? I mean, that's just ludicrous.
Agree with you. The COG screen doesn't seem to be like aerometrically significant.
Well, yeah. And then to your point, it's just I saw the FAA had just removed some of the screening requirements. So the COG screen was one of them.
What they removed was the annual recurrent requirement.
Yeah, the recurrent. So the initial is still required. Yeah.
The initial is still required. And there's no annual recurrent. And I think that might have been a compromise between the people who favor COG screen and the people who disfavor COG screen, because I mean, there's no study to show that this is a useful tool in evaluating a person who's taken SSRIs currently or in the past.
So like you said, you think it was kind of like a compromise for them removing the COG screen, but do you think there's a better way to screen these pilots, that they'll move to a different method, like maybe training or something like that, as you had explained?
Well, I think that for third class pilots, they're not going to be in a sim because they're not flying that kind of aircraft normally. Yeah. I mean, some pilots who are fortunate enough to have their own jet or fly a turboprop like a King Air or a Caravan, they may be required to do sim checks by their insurance. And that's a good thing. And obviously, if they can't pass a sim check, then maybe they shouldn't be flying at all. But as far as the requirement for the COG screen for pilots who are working for an airline, for instance, or are working a corporate job where they're doing sim checks all the time, it just seems crazy to require a cognitive screen that is done by a computer, especially given that they are evaluated on a recurrent basis by a neuropsychologist and or a psychiatrist. It makes no sense for them to have to do makes no sense whatsoever to me.
Yeah, so do you think it's just kind of like a test for liability, like for some a liability-based test for the FAA to fall back on, be like, look, we tested them and they passed?
No, that's I think, I mean, oh, I love it when people say liability, doctors say liability, like supply chain people say COVID. I think that at least from my perspective, that it's not a liability issue. I think it's gotten to be a bureaucratic norm for the FAA and nobody's, you know, got the guts to stop it. It's kind of like EKGs for first class medicals. EKGs don't tell you anything about what predictive, it has no predictive value for who's going to have a heart attack or who's going to be suddenly incapacitated in the cockpit. A resting EKG is essentially an antiquated test. If they really wanted to test pilots for or were concerned about their ability to or their possibility of having a sudden incapacitation or a heart attack, they would do stress tests every 5 years instead of an annual EKG. But nobody's got the guts to make that change. And in fact, I did an article a couple years ago about the fact, just if you look at the cost, an annual EKG for 5 years is about the equivalent of a once every 5 year stress test. And you would be doing the pilot a great favor at doing a stress test every 5 years, given that has much more predictive value of whether they have any heart disease. But, you know, that's an idea that probably won't come around for many years.
Mm-hmm. So at OSH, you had also shared some compelling results regarding a survey that you created. It was non-scientific, but the answers seem to be very in line with a lot of the other studies that have come out in the past couple of years surrounding this subject. So you presented some questions, and I'll just read them off for our audience. So the first one was, have you ever been on an antidepressant and reported it to the FAA? 47% said yes.
Yeah, and that's not reported. It's have they ever flown on with an antidepressant and not reported it to the FAA?
47% said, almost 50%.
Yeah.
The second question was, have you ever failed to obtain healthcare because of the effect it would have on your FAA medical? 63% answered yes. The third question, do you think the FAA handles mental health issues correctly? And this is the most shocking answer. And I just have to say, you reading these off at Oshkosh was, I think, a moment that a lot of pilots really just admired you a lot for, because I know this had to hurt. So yeah, do you think the FAA handles mental health issues correctly? 97% said no. And so my question.
Well, one I'd like to point out, though, this was not a scientific survey in the sense of, I mean, it wasn't a huge number of people. They were self-selected and so on. But even if it was 50% incorrect, or even if it was 75% incorrect, those numbers are still staggering.
Yeah.
And of course, nothing comes out of that, but I mean, I hope the FAA is getting the message. And I think the new federal air surgeon, Dr. Northrop, is really trying to make some changes there, but there's a lot of bureaucratic inertia in Oklahoma City. And you know, a lot of people think that the federal air surgeon can just say, you know, we're going to do it this way, and it happens. And it's not quite that way, but she is, I think, trying to make some changes, but they don't come fast enough, or and they're not enough of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, you know, what was it like in the moment when you were doing this forum, and or more or less when you did this study, when you were able to get these results, what kind of feeling came over you seeing that?
Well, I think it confirmed what I believed from the start, that many pilots do not seek medical care because they're worried about their medical. I mean, I've had pilots say that to me. I've had pilots who've come in literally scared to death they're going to lose their medical because they went to the emergency room and had chest pain. Well, you know, chest pain doesn't mean you have heart condition. And when and so they'll have gone to the emergency room with chest pain, and they would say, well, I had it 4 or 5 days and went to the emergency room. They checked me out and sent me home. Well, that's not a heart attack. That means that you don't have a cardiac problem. And but, you know, pilots will say, gee, I waited that long because I was worried about what would happen to my medical. And that's something that had been said to me many, many times over the years. So the fact that pilots failed to obtain health care, being concerned about their FAA medical, does not surprise me at all. I did a similar question about antidepressants back when AVSIG, which was the first online bulletin board, it was an aviation bulletin board, but literally was the first one on CompuServe. I had pilots send me a postcard if they'd ever flown on antidepressants without informing the FAA. This is before the FAA allowed antidepressants in any form. And I got many postcards with the word yes written on them. So, I mean, I knew that was an issue. And I don't think, I don't run into anybody for the most part who thinks the FAA is handling mental health issues correctly. In and out of the healthcare world, they just are way behind modern medicine.
Oh yeah. So, I was just gonna ask you about the other things that you said at OSH, because you said a lot of good things that we really resonated with and agree with, and one of those things was that you thought that the decision criteria to be delegated more to AMEs, and you being an AME, I kind of wanted to know why you also agree with that, like why you said that.
Well, I think that it's more valid for an AME who's sitting and speaking with a pilot, physically touching and examining the pilot, has a better feel for whether that pilot is safe to fly than somebody in Oklahoma City. Now, we can evaluate the Oklahoma City people require. In other words, they can, like, if they require a stress EKG for somebody who's had a heart attack, and a person flies that stress passes that stress EKG with flying colors, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to certify that pilot to fly for another year. And some of those processes have been delegated down to some extent to AMEs, and those are called CACIs. They're called conditions AMEs can issue. And some of those are conditions that it should never have been on a special issuance list anyways. Disease, like somebody who's hypothyroid is used to be a special issuance, and now it's a CACI or condition AMEs can issue. Asthma, somebody who's not, you know, who's got mild asthma or high blood pressure, prostate cancer that's been treated. Many of these things, there's no reason why AMEs shouldn't have been able to issue them, and now we can. There's actually a list let's see how many other 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. There's 22 now. And you can, if you want to see the list, you just Google FAA CACI, CACI, and the list will come up. But that really could be done for almost all special issuances. And don't forget that the examiner, the FAA AME, has a choice of doing three things when a pilot comes in. They can issue, or they can deny, or they can defer. So if somebody comes in, let's say they come in and they have asthma, and that's a CACI condition. If it's mild asthma and the AME determines using the criteria the FAA set out that there's no reason why he or she can't grant a medical, they can go ahead and grant it. If the pilot applicant has asthma that has certain problems that show severity of disease or requires multiple medications or, you know, other criteria, and the AME thinks that, well, he or she's not comfortable giving him a medical, they can always defer. In other words, just because it's a CACI condition doesn't mean the AME has to say yes or no. They can defer, and that person, that pilot, can still qualify as a special issuance. So by giving the AMEs more discretion on the ability to issue, doesn't mean that everybody who has that condition is going to get their medical, it means that the AME has to make the choice of whether that person is safe to fly or that person needs to be evaluated in Oklahoma City on a more thorough basis or may need additional testing required by the FAA. Now, the reason I'm a strong proponent of the AMEs being delegated more is if you look at basic med over the first 5 years, basic med, which is exams that are done by physicians that are not AME trained or not FAA trained, they can be any licensed physician can do these exams. We have over 70,000 pilots who are on basic med, and the accident rate between basic med and third class pilots is there is no difference. So basically that shows that you don't need to be an AME to do a third class medical. You don't need to do it. And so that's one of the reasons why I think that that AME should be granted much more authority to grant medicals and take this special issuance backlog and get rid of it, because that's what that would do it. I mean, just think about this. I think it's actually over 80,000 pilots are on basic med now. Now, a good percentage of those basic med pilots had special issuances that have gone to basic med. The FAA is so backed up now. Imagine how backed up they'd be if all those folks who are on basic med had actually applied for special issuance under third class. I mean, the backup would even be greater.
A year longer, probably. Wow. For sure. Yeah, I think the stronghold at the top of having all the power definitely needs to be released and given more to allowing an AME to make those decisions, since they are the ones who see the pilots face to face. And I do believe, obviously, you have the credentials to make those decisions. So it's just that power struggle, I feel like they just won't let go of over at OKC.
Yeah. I mean, and I had another pilot just complain to me the other day. He's had atrial fibrillation that was treated with something called ablation. That's where they go in with a catheter and essentially burn the spot that is causing the irregular heartbeat. He's gone 5 years with annual Holter monitors, which are these 24-hour monitors you wear that monitor your heart rate. He's done that for the FAA for 5 years. He's still on a special issuance. He has to do it every year. And the FAA, in spite of the fact that he has been successfully treated and that treatment has looked great for 5 years, he still has to do this test every year and still has to get a special issuance. And there's no reason for that. I mean, at some point, the special issuance should go away. But the FAA has made it a lifelong requirement for anyone who's had atrial fib at any time. That just makes no sense. And, you know, it doesn't mean that, I mean, let's say the pilot went 10 years without atrial fibrillation, then it started again. It still would be reported. In other words, there's no reason why the FAA has to require this Holter monitor, because the AME, when they listen to somebody's heart, can tell if they've got an irregular heartbeat. The pilot's private physician can tell if they've got an irregular heartbeat. I mean, this isn't something that is magically shown by a Holter monitor that no one's ever detected. So some of this stuff just is beyond common sense.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, like, what is the reasoning for them to require these special issuances when you know this person is fit to fly? And I mean, we've seen it. We just talked to a female aviator. She'll be coming on the show in a few weeks, but she's required to hold a special issuance. She no longer takes medication at all. She hasn't taken it for 5 years, I believe, but she's required to have a special issuance every year for medication she took 5 years ago. And she's totally fine now.
Was it ADD?
No, it was just a situational stress.
Yeah. I mean, so, and here's, and this is one of the things that drives me crazy about that. A lot of physicians put pilots on medications saying, oh, it's going to be no problem. You won't have any problem with that. Or because they just don't know how the FAA responds to certain things. or they put people on medications inappropriately. And ADD is one of my pet peeves, because a lot of teenagers get put on ADD medicine for hyperactivity when they are not hyperactive, nor is the diagnosis valid. But because they've been on the medication for a period of time, that means when the pilot fills out that form, have you ever been diagnosed with this, or have you ever taken these medications? You know, that's going to come up, and then they're going to be in this world of hurt, having to prove a negative. And it just is very, very frustrating, because the overdiagnosis in general medicine is extremely high, extremely high.
You're speaking my middle language right now. I've talked about that so much on the podcast, and ADD and ADHD is definitely, like, it seems like to be the biggest culprit of that. I just know in my personal life, so many people who have taken it, and they don't have ADHD, but they've just been prescribed it at one point in their life.
Right. I called it at one point, it was the disease du jour. Prescribed ADD medicines.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you a question that I don't have written down. And if you don't want to answer, I totally understand, and we can cut this out. But I know that a lot of pilots see AMEs as kind of like the key holder, like the one person that can either make or break you being up in the sky. For you as an AME, and kind of asking you about, like, your mental health, how do those decisions affect you as an aviator, as somebody who loves this? You can definitely identify with other people who are struggling. Say you have somebody that's on the SI pathway. Like, what kind of feelings does that bring up for you as an aviator?
Well, I've always felt my position as an AME is to do everything I can to help a pilot fly. My biggest issue is that I get obsessive compulsive about trying to get all the paperwork done and things like that. And sometimes it gets a little frustrating when the pilot doesn't follow through. But I really do everything I can to get pilots processed and get these special issuance through and so on. A lot of physicians, and this is where drives me a little bit crazy with AMEs, it is far easier to defer a pilot than it is to go through all the paperwork to make sure that they're okay to certify. And a lot of physicians just don't want to take that time, particularly physicians who are not pilots, who are just doing AME exams to have a source of income. And so, I mean, doing special issuances, doing HIMSS work, it takes a lot more time than just a routine, you know, AME medical. So, but I, you know, I love aviation. I think pilots are great. It's always fun to have pilots come to the office to, you know, get exams. You know, we talk airplanes all the time, but I think it's important that, at least for me as an AME, to try to do my best at getting people certified.
Yeah. It's definitely, I feel like, a lot of work, and can be I know for me, I would never be able to do something like that because it would be so personal. You know, you really want, like you said, you want to get these people back in the air. You want people to fly. So I can imagine I'm trying to find like a choice word, but I can just imagine that it does play a little bit of a role in your day-to-day life and a little bit of a stressor.
Well, sometimes all of medicine can be stressor.
Yeah. I can only imagine. So our last question for you at the very end here is, what advice would you give someone who is waiting on their special issuance and feels like they just cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, a couple things. One is that they should be calling the FAA at least once a month to the Oklahoma City office to inquire about the status of their medical, because it is not uncommon for medicals to sort of get lost in the morass of things down there. It's also important to remember that when things get sent in, if they're not sent in all at one time, like if a pilot's supposed to send in the hospital medical records and this test and that test and so on, if they're not sent in under one envelope or one time, there's no sort of automatic system that says this file is complete and now it needs to be reviewed. And so sometimes a phone call from the pilot will have the reviewer look to see if the file is complete and then put it in the queue to be reviewed. So that's something that can be important. It's also important to read the letter. And a lot of pilots, for some reason, do not read the letter the FAA sends them. And it's important for them to make sure they follow the instructions in the letter. That being said, sometimes the FAA is so far behind that things that have already been sent in will not have been necessarily scanned into the file, and the pilot will get a letter asking for something that they've already sent in. And that's why these phone calls to the FAA can be important to determine was this just things crossed in the mail or did you never receive this or whatever. By the way, I never send anything to the FAA by regular mail. I always send it by something that they have to sign for. So it's always going to be UPS or FedEx, even if time is not the important issue. But I want to make sure that somebody has signed for it to prove that the FAA has received it. It's also important for the pilot to make sure and save a copy of everything they send to the FAA. And it's important to remember that they do not need to send things to the FAA that the FAA does not ask for. It just adds to the amount of stuff that they review.
Yeah. Don't make a mountain out of a molehill.
Right.
I like your advice. That's something that I never even would think about is you sending that paperwork and them asking for the same paperwork just because so much time has elapsed. They haven't even been able to scan those files in. Lord have mercy, that's got to be frustrating. But I really do like your advice. Yep. Those are things that I think we've said maybe a couple of times here on before, but definitely need to reiterate that. And what you said about keeping a log of everything, I don't think we've touched on that. That's another really good point. But thank you so much for pointing that out and bringing that up. And thank you so much for coming on the show and making time. I know you're a very busy, busy man. I know that a lot of people know your name. So that just goes to show that you're definitely busy. And people in the aviation world, especially pilots, we really admire you and the work that you're doing and the advocacy for air medical reform. So thank you.
You're very welcome. And I do want to point out one thing, by the way, that one thing that the FAA has done that isn't a big improvement is they now will let us upload directly files to the FAA as opposed to having to mail everything in. That's just happened over the past couple months. Before we had to mail everything in, but now we have the ability to upload files via scanner, and that's a big improvement. Now, I don't know if it's going to speed anything up, but at least it's a big improvement.
Yeah, at least you don't have to send it through certified mail.
No, I do want to say, though, I wanted to ask, in that case, like, would you still send something through certified mail just to have that evidence that, you know, it was received, or would you do both?
Well, the thing about the scan is you can tell it when it's uploaded, it's in the system. And so you can tell that it's there.
Me just not trusting the internet. Maddie knows it's like an ongoing joke. I am a grandma inside of a young woman's body because when it comes to technology and any kind of acid reflux, I turn into a complete 80-year-old. But that is good advice. And thank you for mentioning that.
Sure.
All right, Brent. Well, we've definitely taken up enough of your time, so we will let you loose and get back to fighting the good fight. Thank you again for coming on. And if I know you're not like, it doesn't seem like you're very into social media, but if people wanted to contact you, is that something that they can do?
Yeah. The easiest way is just, email me at Brent@BrentBlue.com.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much, Brent. We sure do appreciate it.
My pleasure. You take care now.
All right. That is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening with us this week. As always, remember to keep the blue side up and the brown side down. We'll speak to y'all next week.